It's Alum Group's Andrea Lay, PacFew's Melissa Burdick, live with me here in Connecticut, the Wizard of Woodland Hills Tree, and I'm PBSB from Flywheel, a division of Omnicom. Before we get to the CPG Guys episode you've downloaded, it's the week of April 15th, and it's time for the Fresh Four. Four curated news stories from the past week. We find them hubristically intriguing. We hope you do too. They're brought to you through our partnership with Retail Wit, your one-stop shop for retail industry intelligence and news. RetailWit.com. It's retail right now. Melissa, kick us off.
Hey, Fresh Four listeners. Dollar General celebrates opening its 20,000th store. There you go, 20,000. U.S.-based discount retailer Dollar General has opened its 20,000th store, celebrating the occasion in Alice, Texas. The grand opening celebrations were attended by senior leaders and vendors. Dollar General Executive Vice President of Store Operations and Development, Steve Deckard, commented, "We believe each store provides a positive impact in our hometowns through convenient access to affordable essentials, career growth, opportunities for employees, and the ability for local nonprofits, schools, and libraries to advance through Dollar General Literacy Foundation grants." Dollar General also awarded $20,000 to support educational and tutoring programs through donations to a local library and community group, as well as providing new books to a local elementary school. Dollar General employs more than 17,500 Texas employees through its store, distribution center, and private fleet presence in the state. On to you, Sri.
Thank you, Melissa and Peter. Jessica Alba has actually stepped down as Chief Creative Officer of The Honest Company, a company she founded. So after nearly 12 years of the company, Alba shared the news in an Instagram post on Tuesday, April 9th. "It is with grateful heart that 12 years after founding The Honest Company, I'm stepping down from my leadership role as CCO. However, I will continue to provide strategic advice through my role on the board," Alba wrote. What's next, Peter?
Oreo reimagines ubiquitous internet menu icon to dole out discounts. Mondelez international brand Oreo has launched a commerce activation dubbed the Oreo menu that aims to re-envision the internet's ubiquitous three-line hamburger menu navigation tool as a two-stacked Oreo cookies. Key to the effort is a microsite where consumers can enter any tab or category name they see when clicking on the three-bar menu icon on the internet as a promo code to receive a deal for Oreo cookies that can be redeemed at Kroger as part of an exclusive partnership. The activation includes an explanatory video and is being driven by influencer content along with digital and social media to drive engagement. The effort follows Oreo's first Super Bowl ad in a decade earlier this year. Andrea, what do you have to close us out?
Hello, Fresh Four listeners. Shein has copyright infringement baked into its business model. Shein is facing a class action lawsuit that alleges that the fast fashion company uses an industrial scale scheme of systematic digital copyright infringement against small designers and artists, according to court documents last week. Attorneys for the group of plaintiffs say that Shein uses sophisticated electronic systems that algorithmically scour the internet for popular works created by artists and misappropriates these works to manufacture and sell them as Shein products without attribution to the creators. The complaint is the latest in a series of copyright infringement lawsuits filed against the fast fashion giant, including an ongoing one from last year that claimed violation of the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act.
Thank you, Andrea. That's it for the Fresh Four. Now on to the CPG Guys episode that you've downloaded.
Welcome to another episode of the CPG Guys podcast. Our co-hosts, Sri Rajagopalan and Peter V.S. Bond, explore how brands and retailers engage with consumers online, in-store, and everywhere in between. And now, here are Sri and Peter.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the CPG Guys podcast. I'm PVSB, one of the aforementioned CPG Guys. My area of expertise is voice of the consumer, data science insights, and Everything Loyalty. Now, as always, I'm usually joined by my co-host, Sri, but unfortunately, he is on vacation on the left coast. So I'm going to be flying solo today. But the great thing is the topic that we're covering in this episode and this arc of episodes that we're going to be showcasing is actually around user-generated content, which is my domain. So we'll give Sri a little time off and I'll cover what's going on here. But before we get to our guest in this episode, I want to remind all of our followers that our content, audio, video, documents, links to us on LinkedIn, links to the CPG guys, all of that you can just find by visiting cpgguys.com. And while you're there, do click on the link to our LinkedIn page and follow us, because that's the easiest way to follow everything we're doing, get all the content we're posting. It is our central point for amplifying what we're talking about. Please check it out there. And if you have a moment, you like what you see on the podcast and everything else, stop by ratethispodcast.com/CPGguys. Leave a rating or review on the Apple Podcast. We want to make sure that the content we create is relevant to what you're looking for us to create. We do that now. We want to continue to do that. So ratethispodcast.com/CPGguys. So I'm particularly excited to welcome our guest this week. I've known him for a few years now. He has been a client of PowerViews when he was at Hormel Foods on their leadership team, where he served as the vice president of digital experience. In 2019, he invited me out to Austin. No, not Austin, Minnesota, where Hormel Foods is headquartered, but down to Austin, Texas, where the Digital Food and Beverage Conference was taking place. And he asked me to be on a panel, and I said, sure, and I got to know him a lot better. And ever since then, we talk all the time, and I thought, what a great opportunity to have him come on and advocate for something he's particularly passionate about, but I am also equally excited about. He has tremendous brand management experiences at companies like Clorox and Henkel, and he's got very deep expertise in digital marketing and e-commerce. He's here today to give us an honest and direct point of view on user-generated content, the industry term for consumer ratings and reviews, question and answers, and how brands should be building and leveraging this conversion accelerating experience for consumers up and down the marketing funnel to really drive the path to purchase. So we have a lot to cover. We're going to probably break this up, this episode, into a multi-episode arc. Please join me in welcoming to the podcast, Stephen Coven. Stephen, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Hey, thank you, PVSB. Glad to be here. And I just want to make sure those listening in the audience, did you notice Peter already pushed UGC?
I did.
He said, go to ratethispodcast/CPGguys. He's looking for UGC. I love it.
Stephen just moved to Crossmark as VP of Omnichannel and e-commerce. Sounds like a great role. I gather you report directly to the CEO. A bit of a change. It puts you on the agency side versus the manufacturer side, where you spent most of your career recently at Hormel Foods as the officer of all things digital marketing and e-commerce.
Before we get to the questions, why don't you expand upon with our audience your subject matter expertise as it pertains to consumer engagement and the digital shelf?
Perfect. So for me, when I think about consumer engagement and the digital shelf, it all starts with being consumer-centric, understanding how consumers make decisions, their interests, their biases, and then layering on the best way to communicate with them. In essence, if you have the wrong message or bad creative, it doesn't matter from there. So with consumer engagement, you really have to understand the consumer and then the tools to motivate them to help maybe create awareness or create an action. And within that, for us, or me, I should say, is I think about it in two big buckets. First is there's a lot of MarTech out there, lots of tools to help motivate consumers both offsite and onsite. And the field of MarTech is absolutely exploding. You've got maybe 10 years ago in the hundreds of MarTech companies, and now you've got almost 10,000 probably out there. And so there's a lot of things out there to help really get in front of the consumer, target the consumer, create loyalty and beyond. And then the second element of doing this well in the consumer engagement and digital shelf space is really understanding that digital shelf. Obviously, you've got content that's in front of the consumer. They're looking at it. They're reading it. They're maybe watching videos. So understanding what is available and optimizing it, but then also really understanding that algorithm. Because if you're not found, no one's going to be able to buy it. So really understanding the nuances, the technology, the algorithm is going to allow you to be successful in this consumer engagement effort.
Stephen, that was great, very concise, yet very descriptive. Let's get on to the questions. We know that you share this passion with me. I know it's going to be a very lively conversation. So let's just start off at a very high level and define what the subject we're talking about is. Can you please define in your terms what user-generated content is? And second of all, whether it is measurably important on the path to purchase?
Perfect. Let me address that. So I take UGC generally broader than most. Most people think about it as just online. Within online, people think about ratings and reviews, social posts, images, videos that are generated by the consumer, not the brand. But anything that the consumer generates is really UGC. So what else is out there? It could be someone calling into your call center to give kudos to the new product, a letter, or something else. Maybe at an event, you get some video. So it's not just what happens online. It's really anytime the consumer generates content. And that obviously has a benefit. We'll talk more about it, but in general, it's about authentic views of your product and your brand. It creates trust. It helps educate. There's so many benefits. And so your question on, is this important on the path to purchase? Absolutely. It creates equity. It creates the ability to convert on a page. And so, yes, this is both important, and use the word measurably. It is absolutely something you can measure and understand the impact on your efforts.
Thank you, Stephen. That's great. So let's talk then about how UGC can and actually should be applied in successful e-commerce, particularly on the digital shelf. Any innovative examples come to mind?
Absolutely. So can and should, it absolutely should. And this is really both on the manufacturer, obviously the owner of brands, and on the retailer side. Specifically at retail, if you don't have UGC on your site, you're really losing sales. If we look through the lens of Amazon and what really made them successful when they were just selling books and now they sell everything, it was about great search engine results, but also that UGC of the reviews. They were really the first that put it out there, allowed someone to understand, is this a book I should read or not? And now consumers are used to it. And so you have to have it. I think the study that was recently out was 97% of all consumers use reviews to make a decision, and roughly like I think 26% on every purchase. So you definitely need to have it if you're both on the brand side or on the retailer side. Now, who's doing some innovative things? I think people that are really integrating it fully into, for instance, their PDPs, their product description page, so that, you know, that specific page on a retailer site about your product, those that are really integrating it, moderating it, adding more to it, are the ones that are keeping ahead. And innovative examples is maybe on those tiles, those images that people start with to look at a product, you can talk about your ratings. You can talk about your score, maybe specific quotes that help reinforce certain attributes or equity elements. And then just the unique services that you guys at Power Reviews are doing, leveraging those to even do more when it comes to UGC generation, but also usage.
Yeah, let me expand a little upon that, Stephen. The first one is, you mentioned the image carousel that's at the top of the PDP. Using the page as it exists and not hoping for it to change the way you want it means that you can do something now rather than later. And what I mean by that is, two of the sites like Walmart Grocery and Instacart, they don't have ratings and reviews sections. You know, Walmart.com does, but the grocery pickup and delivery, no UGC. but they do have image carousels. So taking verbatims and putting them in the image carousel, and the Baymart Institute did a product page study a couple of years ago, said the single most important part of the product page is the image carousel. So why not leverage it to communicate? There are a lot of people that only look at that. They never scroll down and go below the fold. So taking advantage of that, I absolutely agree with you. Very innovative ways. You certainly should be tending to your PDP if it has its own UGC section for ratings and reviews and questions and answers. But try to think beyond that. If you do that, you're moving, you're expanding your application on the funnel. And even on the listing pages, right? There are some retailers when they show 20 bottles of shampoo, they don't put a rating and review snippet, the star rating and the review count. That's a big miss, because our data also shows that 50 to 75% of grocery basket ads occur on a listing, on a search page. You can go right to conversion as opposed to evaluation. It's a pretty quick transaction. So really innovative ways to think about it.
You know, let me build on that. You know, through that lens of consumer-centric, we as, you know, consumers like to look at things before reading things, and we'll watch a video before reading. And so if you're in that image carousel, maximize it, because that's, as you said, that's where they start. And it's less likely they're going to read or do something beyond that. You start, there's diminishing returns per se. So bringing that review, that content, that UGC content into the image carousel is going to be a benefit.
Stephen, one of the questions I get most frequently in my role is, what impact does UGC have based upon the product category? I mean, is it really important to collect reviews for a 2-liter bottle of soda or asparagus? You know, what other factors may influence the importance of UGC?
Great questions. And I get that also. So, you know, all categories, it's important. There's obviously some that are more important and some that are less. But if you have zero, for instance, reviews, consumers are going to go, what's going on? Why does this not? They're expecting to have information on it, even on a Pepsi product. So let's say you went to a website and it just had a Pepsi product and a Coke product. Coke had some reviews, Pepsi didn't. Right there, there's some sort of red flag to the consumer. So it is really the cost of doing business on a PDP. You know, some categories that are more established, it's going to be less important, but still important. Ones that are higher involvement, maybe higher price tag, that have something else to it, those are ones that are going to have the need, the requirement to have even more reviews. You know, what factors influence it? Is this a category that is new? Is this a category that, you know, they're only sort of buying seasonally, and so they're not really thinking about that often? Let's use tax software, for instance. You know, you only are thinking about it, obviously, when you're about to start, you know, doing your returns. And so it's not something we're thinking about day in and day out, but those reviews can help a lot. So there's lots of factors. Those are just a couple.
What about new items, Stephen? Are they useful for new items when you're launching a product?
Absolutely. And so you really need those reviews to create that credibility that this is a good product. It meets the needs that you're expecting as someone that would be purchasing it. So my rule is, don't launch it unless you have reviews. Now, it is a little bit harder, because to generate those reviews, you're likely to do sampling in some pre-launch effort. But it's real important, because the studies have shown zero reviews means extremely lower sales than even just having one review. So help the product succeed against the algorithm and make sure that product moves so you can keep it in distribution. You really have to come out of the gate with reviews when you initially launch. Don't launch and then get the reviews. Do it simultaneously.
Yeah, to that point, my advice to any brand is, do not let a product appear on the digital shelf for the first time unless there are consumer reviews attached to it, because that's going to drive trial. In the absence of them never having seen the product or tried the product, they want to hear from someone else who has. That is what is going to stimulate trial more than anything else.
Absolutely. And we're just, you know, we're consumers. And even if it's a $3 item, is it worth taking the risk to try the new one because of just you got to deal with the return, or you lost $3, or, you know, it's for a family gathering and you can't have that whatever fail. These are things that consumers are processing very fast when they're trying to make that purchase decision on a retailer side.
I know that the grocery industry has been slow to adopt the application of UGC on the path to purchase. Mass merchants, drug, big box retailers, much more early on adopters of this format. But all of a sudden the pandemic hits and there is a massive shift to e-commerce around grocery. So there all of a sudden are a whole lot of brands that are scrambling to start investing in UGC where they hadn't. Can you walk our audience through exactly how to get a UGC program up and running for a brand and what needs to be considered in developing this program?
Great question. So if you're not into this space, let's get moving. It's essential, obviously, we'll talk about more about generating sales. The process of getting up and running is really, you need to have a partner here. A partner that's going to take in the reviews. So these are SaaS platforms. They're going to have the technology to put on your brand website to capture the reviews, moderate them. And what moderation means is making sure that the review is a good review in the sense, not that it's positive or negative, but it fits against the right product. It's talking about things that are related to the product, not something totally off the mark. And then really cutting out things that are, you know, issues if there's bad language and such. And then also another set of eyes if there's something that needs to be escalated, if there's an issue either with the product or something that might have hurt someone per se. So you need the moderation, but then what's really, really important is you need to make sure that you can take this UGC and publish it. And the term in the industry is syndication. You need to have a partner that allows you to syndicate your content, all these reviews and the ratings associated with it, as broadly as possible so they can be ingested into the Walmart.com website or a grocery website. So those are the key things. You need to have someone to help obtain them, ingest them into your brand website, someone to moderate them, and then someone to syndicate them. And that's what are the key things to getting up and running. And so we'll need, if you're in the space, you're going to need a partner with someone like PowerViews to get that going.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that concept of moderation. Moderation is around authenticity, so fraud detection of fraudulent IP addresses.
Yeah.
You mentioned the profanity filter. You also mentioned appropriateness and relevance. If someone writes a review and says the box arrived 2 days late and it was soaking wet because it was outside all night, that's not actually about the product. That's about the shopping experience. So right. Making sure that you can moderate a tremendous amount of content through AI. You can do profanity filtering and fraud detection, other things. But sometimes having human eyeballs take a look at content is incredibly important. At PowerViews, we're the only major player to moderate 100% of all content that gets published is moderated through human eyeballs, which means they catch things like what I described. And that can be extremely important. Visual content, images and videos, that requires more often than not the most human moderation. Little tidbit of information. Stephen, do you know what is the most submitted visual image in a rating and review submission?
I'm smiling here because I know the answer because...
Why don't you go ahead and tell everybody?
It's pretty much a selfie or a selfie with the product is my guess.
It's mostly the selfie. Okay. For some reason, people seem to think that, oh, they want a picture of the person who authored it. Well, that's nice, wonderful, but no, we're actually looking for the image. So more often than not, images get moderated out and not published because they're not relevant, again, to the product, or the person who authored it. But as part of that content acquisition, making sure you have the rights to be able to share it. And a lot of people don't realize, if you go to sites like Walmart and BJ's Wholesale Club, you'll see that most of the content there is written and it says it was originally written on brand.com site. Mm-hmm. That's syndication, right? That's how they get content there. So thank you for...
Yeah. And let me add a couple other things that just this conversation inspired me on. Is first is, you need to play within the rules within the FTC. So, you know, playing by the rules is the right way. And the FTC is watching this closely. And you need to have a partner that understands that. You know, you can't just have only positive reviews and weed out the negatives. You have to have it all. And we'll talk about that, I expect, the fear of negative reviews. But you also need to make sure that you have that human moderation. AI is just not strong enough. It's not strong enough in this space. It's not strong enough in many other spaces where AI has lots of potential, but it's still not there where it can fully replace human insight. And I've seen it, AI in this space, missing things in other spaces. So human moderation is critical in this effort.
Absolutely, Stephen. I'd like to expand a little bit upon what you mentioned in terms of having a partner that helps make sure that you don't run afoul of authenticity issues. Authenticity is not just that someone actually wrote the review about the product, but consumers understand what motivated that review. The FTC has guidelines around incentivized reviews.
Yes. So
by getting a sample or a sweepstakes, that needs to be badged on the review, and you will, and a good partner will actually do that. There are some people out there that scrape reviews from other sites, don't capture the badging, don't display that. If there is a review published and it was sourced through a sampling or a sweepstakes, and it's not badged accordingly, that's going to get the FTC very angry at you. They're also going to get angry at you, to your point, what you said, is if you're artificially suppressing reviews. There are some platforms out there that'll let brands with a click of a button just suppress all the low-rated reviews. Well, there was a big case last week where one of our competitors was found guilty and as being fined for doing exactly that. So we'll talk a little bit. We'll dig into that negative review and why not to be worried about it. But those are, that really gets around it.
Absolutely. There's no need as a brand person or someone in e-commerce to take a call from your general counsel and explain this. Work within the rules and you'll be fine. And if something's wrong in this sense, this feedback on your product, it means you got to change something. Maybe it's the formula or what you're communicating on the page. But gaming the system, the FTC is watching this, is only getting stronger at applying the rules against manufacturers and retailers. So I also want to say, you know, one that we skipped is employees. You know, employees shouldn't be writing a review on a product without disclosing that. That's part of the rules. So it's very important to ensure that, again, you're working within the guidelines of the FTC.
Absolutely. And the way you display that and ensure that it is displayed correctly is you should instruct your employees to only write reviews using their company email address. Good platform providers like PowerReviews will set up and implement the program such that when a review comes in from a company email address, it will be badged as a review from a staff member. So that is also very important. So let's say to that point on implementation, you've designed your program, you've selected a vendor, now you go and actually implement. Can you speak to some specific concerns that brands should address during the implementation phase?
Yeah, I'll highlight some. It involves a lot of work to do it right. But let me highlight some things for our audience just to make sure they don't run into these or are aware of them as they work on implementation. So first, on the implementation side, it's just making sure, obviously, you know your scope. What is in scope? Which brands, which SKUs, and things like that. You also need to organize them. If you have the formula that's the same in seven sizes of the same thing, you can group those. And any review against that group can be then syndicated out to those seven items. So that's one thing, thinking about how you can group your products. The other thing is just making sure that people are ready within your organization to do the implementation, especially on the technical side. So you're going to need to work with a provider in the sense to implement this into your website and structure it so it looks and feels like what your brand would be serving up to consumers. So it looks, I'll call it within the style guide. But within that, within the questions that are asked on a review, that's a great time to step back and say, what do we really want to ensure that we know from our consumer? So there are standard templates that are out there, but making sure as an organization, you step back and you think about what are the real key questions that you want to ask? Maybe it's a new one or custom and things like that, just to ensure that you're capturing it. Like anyone in research knows that the more questions you ask, the less likely they're going to finish, per se, the survey, the research. So we have to be selective when we're doing it. So it's a balance of asking everything you want to know, but not having too many questions. And then there's some great technology out there to help motivate on the site someone to answer a question. It might show how much they've answered the survey questions and give them that motivation to complete it. So really taking a close look at the tools available from the supplier, making sure your organization's ready to integate it and integrate it with some thought, then you're ready to go and put it into your system and your site.
Stephen, I loved your comment about motivating your consumer to write more and write more poignant content. Having a review meter on the bottom that as they start to enter more characters, eventually goes from red to yellow to green, can really get them to write a more robust response. Also, to your point on adding additional questions and even putting them ahead, so specific questions, apparel manufacturers oftentimes like to ask consumers whether the fit of the product is too small, too big, or just right on. And when you start adding some of those, a handful of them in advance of the free form, oftentimes you will find those attributes will find their way into the free form. So there are a lot of things. And then the great point you made is products that are the same, but they're different variants. So you use that example. I'll give you a great one. Mount Gay Rum, you can buy them in a little airplane bottle, traditional 750 milliliter, or even the 1.75. Those are all basically the same beverage. You can write reviews on it. As a point of fact, I always seem to write my reviews on the 1.75 liter size. No judgments there, people, but in any event.
You hold a lot of parties.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Pre-pandemic.
It's not pandemic related. No.
With implementation, because there's a lot of things involved, one thing I didn't mention is moderation.
Yeah.
You have to have that insight and visibility and execution of moderation in-house also. Obviously, like PowerViews is a great partner and they're doing everything from the AI to the human moderation, but you still need a group internally if something needs to be reviewed or escalated. And so what I found when you're doing implementation is really setting up service level agreements, SLAs. And so we know what the response time is. If something is something that's escalated, is that taken care of in 6 hours, 12 hours a day? Do we have a guide to help answer expected questions? So for instance, sometimes maybe there's a product that's considered too salty as an example. So does the brand already have written a response that helps the consumer understand it and maybe guides them to a product that has less of that type of taste? those are the things that are really important in that upfront effort to do the implementation, because you don't want to be that brand that just puts the carbon copy answer back on the website like, oh, sorry to hear, please call us. What you've done is you've really not helped strengthen the brand, and you haven't really addressed what the concern was. So, you know, from a strengthening the brand, it shows like, we're not willing to invest to help this person. And then on the second part, maybe there's an opportunity to say, well, this product has this, and this other product has what maybe what you're looking for, so try that. And so you can really use it as an opportunity to help the next person understand more of what's going on, because we do know, and again, we're, you know, it's about the negative reviews, that that's where consumers go. They don't go to the 5-star, they go to the 1-star and try to understand, you know, what went wrong. And we as brands or retailers want to be right there to help answer that bad review and help guide that next consumer on more information to help them. So you don't have another 1-star review, you've helped them in the process.
Yep. You mentioned not only having a predefined list of responses to the most frequent comments, but it's also about structuring that so that it's reflective of the style of the brand. Like how you respond to a question if you're OTC medication is very different than if you're talking about a toy or candy, right? The latter are going to be more fun, jovial. And in the case of the former, you're going to have to deal with things like adverse conditions. So having custom moderation, probably by a pharmacist, is something that many OTC medication brands will actually contract companies like Power Reviews to do, because they want to make sure that if there is a safety issue, that it's notified immediately. And that's why the SLA comes in. So I think you're spot on that, Steve.
Yeah, and it can go really wrong really fast if you're in that space and the consumer starts talking about the product and what it's solving. But if you have it not set up correctly, every time they talk about it, it could be an adverse effects, you know, escalation.
Yep.
And so really doing the upfront work can minimize that for a true escalation versus they're just talking about, I'll call it a usage occasion or the product name.
Mm-hmm. All right. I've chosen my vendor. I've implemented. It's all sitting out there ready for me to go. And I want to start collecting content. So here's the million-dollar question, Stephen. How many reviews do I need? And let me follow that up with, if I hit that imaginary threshold that I've come up with, am I done? Can I just walk away and say, I got my review count. I'm all set.
No. Great question. Absolutely. That's the million-dollar question. This is not a spectator sport. So even in that implementation phase, the teams working on this should be determining how they're going to generate reviews. Number one, is it sampling? Is it social based or something else? But then what is the target? Because obviously budgets are tight. You couldn't just go to a million reviews. That's obviously inefficient. So the goal is, how do you determine what's the right level? Well, you sort of have to triangulate into it. You have to understand where you're at from a standpoint of the competition. You know, that's one way to look at it. There's another thing, the research has shown that in general, excluding categories that, you know, which category you'd be in, that you continue to get benefit at 100, at 200, but it starts having a little bit of a decay. What we do know is that as everyone continues to get into this space, that the, you know, 100 is going to be not enough, and maybe 200 is going to be the next 100. And so you have to look at all those factors, obviously your budget, but you need to start. I would say looking at all those factors is important, but if you were forcing me to say, you know, Stephen, just give me a number, I'd say 100 is somewhere to start with.
I'm absolutely with you on that one. But you also know, as you said, that there are some categories. You and I were talking about this the other day. We saw one category on Amazon where some of the products had 275,000 ratings. It's hard, to your point, of getting into the game when that's it. But making sure that you're doing that is pretty important.
I want to say you're even if it's intimidating that someone maybe is 1,000 or 2,000, you got to start because it impacts that conversion. That if you don't have those reviews, they're not going to buy it. So you're going to have to do it regardless if someone has 1,000 or you have zero.
Yeah.
And then also you've got to get it going for the algorithm. And so depending on the retailer's algorithm, maybe recency is more important than just a straight up number of reviews. And so don't put your head down and say, I can't do this. You know, we'll never get there. There's other factors as you unpack a rating, you know, it can influence the algorithm. So recency, as I just mentioned, was it considered a helpful review? Does the website allow the consumers to, you know, crowdsource, is this important or useful or not? And so many factors are beyond just the quantity of the review, the quality of it. So
how does quality work into that? I mean, does the star rating matter? You talked about some other things like recency. What are some other factors from your perspective that contribute? Maybe they're not in the search algorithm, but they're in the minds of consumers that they may discount or elevate a product based upon whether they have these other factors in the UGC that's being displayed.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors when we sort of break it down on a rating and a review. So, you know, from the top of my mind, I think of recency. You know, you're a little worried as a consumer if you come to a product and the last review was 9 months ago. So what's going on there? Is anyone buying it? So recency is important. You know, people know products change over time. And so that's one to think about. Depending on the category, length is important. I think it's always better to have a little bit more than less. But, you know, talking about a banana for, you know, 7 paragraphs might be overkill. But, you know, if you're talking about an electric lawnmower, that's probably some, you know, reasonable because there's so many attributes to be thinking about.
Yeah, I hate when I get a review for a lawnmower and it says awesome. I'm glad you like it, but it's not really helping me as someone who's now evaluating the product that you bought as to whether it's good and for what reason. So yeah, promoting, we talked about length and ways you can promote that. So very important. What else are you thinking?
Sentiment. You know, is this review giving the rest of the audience, the shoppers, something positive? So are they rating it up as helpful or not? So that's relating to the whole quality of the review by the reviewer. Also, there's the aspects of what's the range of the reviews? Is it just all concentrated at 5 and 1s? You know, then that shows a little bit of like this, what's that problem that's creating that? Because people are expecting a distribution that's more, you know, some 5s, some 4s, some 3s, and a little bit heavier on the 1s, you know, versus like a 2-star. But if it just is hitting on what I call the bookends of a rating, that usually is a red flag. Like, what's going on that it's so binary, you know, that, you know, so it's something to watch and influences, you know, consumers in their decision-making. You know, did they add even more UGC? So many sites allow for, as we discussed, the ability to upload a selfie or one that just shows the product, hopefully. And then, you know, we probably be moving to videos. And so that, you know, all those things, the quality of it really is important, you know, especially equity and fashion friendly type brands. You really want to cultivate that, you know, your consumers, the consumers that are younger are looking for, how is it tied to their lifestyle? How do they integrate into their life? So, you know, when we get to more rich content, that's also important when it comes to quality.
Absolutely. I would agree with you. And then we talked a little bit earlier, the supplementary product relevant questions that are asked that can really come into consideration. I talked about apparel and the right fit and other things like that. Those are very important in terms of the effectiveness.
Yeah. And that, you know, we've talked a lot about ratings and reviews, but in this effort, I would say join your FAQ effort with your ratings and reviews when you're doing the setup, selection, implementation, moderation, all that. Do it all as one because they really overlap. And people want their questions answered. And so if you're not doing that, you're creating a bad user experience and maybe ending up having someone buy it that rates it poorly, that's bad, or buys it and they didn't get their answer from the FAQs and they return it. So these are all things that with UGC, you can really manage your destiny better. But if you don't, you're going to have some problems.
All right. That's very helpful. So I've selected my vendor. I've implemented, I've designed the right writer review form to collect all the content in the order I want so that I know it's going to be wonderful. Now I actually have to collect the content. So Stephen, what are some major ways to generate the content? And since I like Wheel of Fortune, you know how at the end, when the person goes to the big final puzzle to solve and Pat Sajak takes the RSTLNE and puts it up on the board and they automatically get that. I'm just going to throw right on the table that for brands, the single biggest way to collect content is if you're doing D2C, it's order feeds, right? You've got people who've bought products off your site. That's the biggest. But there are a lot of brands, and you just came from a manufacturer where D2C, because you were a perishable manufacturer, was kind of off the table. So I'd sure love to hear from you different ways that brands that may not have order feeds can start to think about how do I collect meaningful content at scale.
And so what else is out there to help generate this content? So leveraging marketing tools. So it might be a social effort that focuses on creating reviews, maybe through a sweepstakes or some other promotion. Obviously, as we talked about, need to make sure that's identified when you capture it. It could be something you integrate on your packaging. You know, we want to hear from you. And so this really, the sky is the limit to engage your consumer because consumers like to talk and share their feedback. And it's not just, you know, talking about cars that are very, you know, high involvement. Every product category I've ever been in, there are consumers that want to talk about it. If they're using it, they want to talk about it. And so I think looking through your sort of touch points of interacting with a consumer, if again, your packaging, your advertising, your follow-up, if someone calls your help center, you could ask them, hey, if you don't mind, I know that you like our product. Do you mind going to brand.com and writing a review? So it's really being integrated in the effort, looking for all those places to really pull in reviews. And as we know, more reviews means more sales and more conversion.
I'm working with a client right now that's starting to integrate QR codes onto their packages, to your point, making it very easy because all iPhones and most Android phones have a QR code reader built into the camera app. So just hovering over the QR takes it right to the writer review page. Very simple. Now, does it generate an enormous amount of content all at once? No, it doesn't. But it gives you a steady stream of organic content. Why is that good? You mentioned it earlier, recency, right? We know that Gen Z, they tend to discount reviews that are over 60 days old. This just gets you 5, 6, 10, 15 reviews a month. You know what? That's pretty good. Now, if you need something all at once, sampling can be a really effective way to do that. Using a sampling community who will write a review in exchange, very helpful. But you mentioned other assets, right? You have social media following. Ask your followers to write a review through social media. You have a CRM database of people who like your, if you're a company like Campbell's Soup and you've got You've got products that are used in recipes, and you've collected their email addresses. We had one client who just sent out an email blast asking people who'd signed up for their CRM database to just write reviews. They got 1,000 reviews in a weekend. It cost them nothing. So a lot of really great ways. Work if you work with a good UGC provider, they should have as part of their client success team consultants who will help you do that. And it's part of the service that you are paying for. So
yeah, I totally agree. And this is not a set it and forget it. This is something that you need to have a strategy in place to continue to add to your review count. Maybe, as you said, not as much as you had at the beginning because you're maybe going from 0 to 100, but the maintenance needs to be set up. So if it's a drip off of a QR code on your product packaging or something else, you have to have in place that ability to continue to add to your ratings reviews count.
All right, everyone, that is going to be the end of the first episode of our series with Stephen Coven. Please join us in the next episode, and we will continue this conversation around UGC. The content in this podcast episode is provided for general informational purposes only. By listening to our episode, you understand that no information contained in this episode should be construed as advice from CPG Guys LLC or the individual author, hosts, or guests, nor is it intended to be a substitute for research on any subject matter. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by CPG Guys LLC. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. The views expressed by CPG Guys LLC do not represent the views of their employers or the entity they represent. CPG Guys LLC expressly disclaims any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or other damages arising out of any individual's use of, reference to, or inability to use this podcast or the information we present in this podcast.